Welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Katie Streeter here at NQF. I'm with Poonam Bal and Lindsay Tagg and Karen Johnson. So welcome to our Endocrine Standing Committee post-comment call. Before we begin, I just would like to take a quick roll call. Do we have Tracy Breen?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
Bill Curry?
Present.
Vicki Duckworth?
I'm here.
Jim Duddle? Jim Duddle? Ingrid Duva? Bill Golden? Ann Kern?
Yes, I'm here.
Sue Kirkman?
I'm here.
Ann Letty?
Here.
Grace Lee? I'm sorry, was that Grace? Laura Makeroff? If you're streaming or watching through the webinar, if you could just put your computer on mute, please. Anna McAllister?
I'm here.
Patty McDermott? Janice Miller. James Rosenzweig. Claudia Swyslavin. Jesse Sullivan. Bill Taylor.
I'm here.
And Starlin Hayden, greeting. Okay, anyone that I may have missed that joined
Hi.
After? Okay.
Claudia Schweid-Slavin.
Hi, Claudia.
Hi, sorry, I got disconnected.
No problem.
Hi, this is Janice Miller.
Thank you.
And this is Ingrid Duva.
Okay, great. Okay, so I guess let's go ahead and begin. I'm going to turn it over to Karen, who will walk us through today's agenda.
Okay, thank you, Katie. So today, just to make sure everybody knows our goal for today, as you know, we put out our draft report about just a little over a month ago, and we set that out for a 30-day public and member comment. And what we've done now is we've gathered all the comments, and we have internally we have provided some draft responses to the ones that we could. Some of the comments required responses from developers. Some required responses from NQF staff. Generally, those had to do with process or something like that. And then some require responses from you as the steering committee. So we've put draft responses out. We've provided those to you. And on this call, there are some of the comments that really need some extra attention from you. And so that's what this memo is about. It's trying to walk you through in an organized way all the different comments that came through. So just a couple of things to remember before we get started. I've pulled out the ones and organized them in the way that we want to discuss them today. But if there happens to be a comment and or a response that you would like to discuss in addition to the ones that I've called out specifically in the memo, don't lose that thought. We will come back to that toward the end of the call. So with that, I think we will go ahead and get started. So what I tried to do in this memo was remind you, because our meeting was actually 3 months ago, so it's hard to believe that time has really flown that quickly. The first measure that we want to talk about is measure 2468. adherence to oral diabetes agents for individuals with diabetes mellitus. And this measure, you will recall, I think, that you guys did not recommend this measure for endorsement. It went down on the validity subcriterion. And in our in-person meeting, you as a committee, basically the major difficulty with this measure was the patients who were on oral meds who were switched to insulin, you weren't comfortable with how that was handled in the measure. So the developer has actually gone back. They've used that 30-day comment period to look at their measure and their data, and they have actually brought back to you a respecification of this measure. So I think the easiest way to go through this would be to open it up to Kyle Campbell, who is the developer for this measure. And just so you know, we did receive three comments about this measure, and they all agreed with your decision at the time to not endorse the measure. So they think you guys hit it in terms of the problem with the measure. So what we will do now, I think, is open it up to Kyle, let him describe to you what he has done with the measure, and then you guys can discuss the measure itself and decide if you would like to re-vote on the measure. So you don't have to, but if you feel like that he, that Kyle and his colleagues have addressed your concerns, you are certainly free to change your mind. So we'll hear from Kyle, and then you guys can discuss. So, Kyle?
Hey, Karen, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
All right, great. Just want to make sure I had an open line. So, good afternoon. My name is Kyle Campbell, and I'm a pharmacist and the executive director at FMQAI for the CMS Medication Measure Special Innovation Project. As Karen mentioned, at the steering committee on February 21st, we received very constructive feedback regarding improving measure validity for NQF 2468 by revising the measure to account for patients that might switch from oral therapy to an insulin-only regimen. In addition, in the interim period, we did receive a comment during the public comment period that we also addressed the use of incretin mimetic therapy, which is indicated, it's an injectable, they are injectable medications, and they are indicated for treatment of diabetes alone. So we also evaluated that as part of this as part of this measure revision. So I don't know, Karen, is it possible to open up the memo that we provided to the steering committee?
Yes, it
yeah,
should
just
be.
Give us a second.
Okay. I think the easiest thing to do, because we did respecify the measure and we conducted additional analyses, I think the best thing to do is just walk through that memo. And while they're doing with that, we just recognize that the committee considered this measure to be very important, and we really appreciate the opportunity to revise the specification to improve validity. So thank you for your consideration of the measure today. So the first question we asked ourselves in revision of the measure was, what proportion of patients in the denominator use insulin and incretin mimetics? And so in the 10-state 100% sample that we have of the Medicare administrative data, we found about 24% of those patients had at least one claim for insulin, and a little less than 3% had a claim for one of the incretin mimetic drugs. So then further, to evaluate this issue of switching, we looked at the proportion of individuals who switched from an oral diabetes agent to insulin or the incretin mimetic only therapy during the measurement period. So again, looking at the overall 10-state sample of data that we had, we looked among those who had at least one claim for insulin and found that about 13% switched from an oral diabetes agent to insulin-only therapy. And then among those who had at least one claim for an incretin mimetic, a little less than percent switched from an ODA to an incretin mimetic-only therapy. And so that suggested to us, as the committee brought to our attention, that this potentially was, you know, large enough to require respecification of the measure to address in terms of validity. So with number three, how are individuals who switch from ODAs to insulin or these incretin mimetic drugs identified? We identify them by looking whether they have at least one claim for any type of insulin or incretin mimetic after the end of the day's supply for the last oral diabetes agent. So let's say at the six-month mark, you had a patient that was on metformin, and that day's supply, you know, ran out during the six-month period. If that patient had at least one claim after that period, they were considered to be switching to an insulin-only regimen, or if it was an incretin mimetic, an incretin mimetic regimen. So then we thought, how would we operationalize adherence to ODAs for these individuals who switched to insulin? And I know originally the committee had thought perhaps we should exclude, you know, these patients that receive insulin, but since it's such a large proportion of the denominator, we thought the best way to do it was to potentially create an algorithm that would account for a fair measurement of their oral medication regimen. So basically, the individuals that have their ODA measurement period is set to the end of the day supply of the last ODA prescription during the measurement year. So for that patient on metformin, let's say they started, you know, January 1, they continued for 6 months, their adherence to the metformin would be calculated for that period from month 1 to 6. And the same thing could be said for, you know, any patient that was switching to or on any other oral regimen, I should say. Now, the other thing in review we took to our team endocrinologists was, should the measure specification also address potential switching between ODAs so that we don't underrepresent adherence if patients are switching from, let's say, you know, metformin to a sulfonylurea, and there's, you know, switching between the oral medication classes. And it was felt that since there's so many different types of complexity in terms of the way that these drugs could be switched between each other, that we would just calculate adherence across the entire class of oral diabetes agents. So if the patient was on, again, in our metformin example, if the patient was on metformin at, you know, month 1 through 6, but they switched over to a sulfonylurea at month 5, you know, then the adherence would be calculated across, you know, their adherence to those drugs across the whole drug class. So there would be no penalty or disincentive for switching, you know, switching patient therapy. And I think you can go to the next page if you scroll down. So then, what are the proposed impacts of these specification changes that we're recommending to you? So we basically reran all of the measure results, including the reliability and validity. And the measure rates increased approximately 1 to 3% across each level measured in the overall mean. We still identified a substantial gap in performance with a mean rate of 76% overall. And variation in performance generally remained between, you know, 10 to 14% when comparing the 10th and 90th percentile at each level. And we provided the full, you know, results for you in the appendix to this memo. And the reliability, which was originally high, remains adequate, you know, across all levels of measurement. And the convergent validity for the measure, where we looked at correlation with other adherence, another adherence metric that is endorsed, actually improved somewhat. And those results are in Appendix B. So to summarize, the final recommendations and conclusions that we have for the steering committee is to revise the specifications to account for individuals switching to either insulin or incretin mimetic-only therapy, and to also calculate adherence across all oral diabetic agent drug classes collectively rather than by individual class. And the proposed revision to those specifications are shown in red. So what we provided here for you is the original specifications, and then the items in red are either where we clarified the language or we added information that discusses, you know, how we operationalized this identification of switching for patients. And if
Thanks,
you scroll,
Chris.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you scroll on down, then, you know, the results for both reliability and validity are presented in full. And I'd be happy to, you know, take any questions or if there are any questions about the results or what's been presented so far.
So let's go ahead and open it up to the committee for Kyle's changes. So what do you think?
So this is Sue Kirkman. I just had a question. I wasn't clear. Are you going to try to measure adherence to insulin therapy if they switch? Because that's fairly difficult to do.
Yeah, no, we are not. We're truncating the measure is still to measure adherence to oral diabetic agents only.
Okay.
We're just
so
truncating the measurement period, yeah, for those patients.
Okay, so you'll just take them out of the, they won't subsequently be part of the measure.
Correct. Yeah, that period of time won't be part of the adherence calculation. So if the patient, in my example again, if the patient had 12 months of therapy, 6 months metformin, 6 months insulin, that follow-up period, the 6 months with insulin only, won't be included in the calculation.
So this is Bill Golden. This is a measure, if there ever was one, where a socioeconomic adjustment might be indicated. When you did your validity checking and you're looking at the different groups, were you able to look at the socioeconomic characteristics of the patient populations about FQHCs or Medicaid populations, health literacy issues? This one, I think, if you're comparing providers, could have a huge impact in a normative way.
Yeah, so we did look in our original measure submission, not in the revised measure submission, we did look at the differences between the dual eligible population as well as the non-dual eligible population. And we did do, I mean, in terms of socioeconomic analysis, that's pretty much all that we looked at. And I'll have to get to that section of the form because it's part of the original submission.
For our process, do some of us jump in while others are asking questions? Do we wait our turn? How do we do this? This is Bill Taylor wondering.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Bill Golden, thank you for that question. But for those of us who don't see the connection, why is this a measure, if any, is one where socioeconomic status should be adjusted for?
Just because of co-pays, management of multiple medications. I have a couple of patients in my practice that if they're on 5 or 6 drugs, they end up taking 3 or 4. Just a variety of factors that limit their ability to regularly get their medicines filled.
Thanks.
Kyle, were you able to find your data from duals, non-duals from your original analysis?
Yeah, I just was able to pull that up. In it is true in age groups greater than or equal to 65 years of age, non-dual eligible individuals did have higher rates of adherence than those who were dual eligible. The difference, and again, we did not compare this across the various provider levels. We compared it across the 10-state sample. But the dual eligible population had a mean adherence rate for this measure of 69.4%, and the non-dual eligible population had a mean of 74.6%. These measures, because I will say these measures, because they are process, like all of the other NQF adherence measures, have not generally been risk adjusted at all.
And this is Karen. I will say that most of you probably know that NQF is in the middle of some work thinking about SES adjustment for outcome measures or other types of measures. And that that work has not been completed. The initial recommendations of that panel was that outcome measures should be adjusted for SES, and even some process measures perhaps should be. But again, those are draft recommendations. They have not yet been considered by our governing bodies. So what we're asking committees to do is to think about things in our current regime, which is SES adjustments is not something that we would necessarily expect. Any other comments from the committee? Everybody understand the changes that Kyle made and the effects on the measures?
Well, I guess the question is, if there is a measure that might have a socioeconomic impact, what would NQF do about it when it gets released? Is there some, because the implication here was about performance gaps, and this, I mean, it's not necessarily the performance gap of the provider necessarily, or maybe even the health system, but it's just generally there is a disparity, but it may not be a performance gap per se.
Right. So I think one of the things that the SES group is struggling with now is just realizing that looking at performance measurement and quality improvement is a kind of a different question than thinking about disparities. So I think where they're leaning, although this is not, they are still very much in their voting on recommendations and stuff, there is still the opportunity to stratify by different groups so that, you know, internally you can do your internal QI and you can see if there are disparities, you know, in your own shop, if you will. So, and that would be the case anyway, you know, even without some kind of a risk adjustment. So I think where they're landing right now is that it's the stratification that would give you information about disparities. Any other questions or discussion on this measure?
This is Bill Taylor. This is confusing, right? I mean, this is a complex area where there's an additional level of complexity now introduced where you figure out when somebody stopped their oral agent and switched to insulin and how it's computed. It seems to me there's an opportunity for unintended consequences that we might not be seeing, in, you know, to read a measure now and hear about it and vote on it. Is there an opportunity to have it considered more, you know, more public comment, us to think about it and so on, or is there a rush to decide right now whether this sufficiently addresses the concern that was raised?
Well, what we would do now is I just need a nod from the committee as to whether the changes that Kyle has made makes you at least want to reconsider your revote. So just to remind you, this measure failed initially on validity. So if you decided that you do want to revote, we would ask you to revote on validity, and the new analyses that Kyle provided would be what you would be looking at there. But then we would go on and have you discuss feasibility and then usability and use. And it is those potential unintended consequences that would come up under the usability and use sub-criterion. So you would have a chance to discuss that just like you did in the in-person meeting.
And I'll just tag on to Karen's comment. In the draft report, it was clear that the reason the committee voted this measure down was because there was no exclusion for patients who were switched to insulin during the measurement period. And the comments that we received were very much in line with and in agreement that there needed to be an exclusion for insulin patients. We didn't receive comments on the other aspects of the measure.
Mm-hmm. And even though I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, in the usability and use discussion where you're thinking about potential unintended consequences, the intent is not to think about, you know, theoretical ones that may happen, but they really that discussion is supposed to really focus on consequences where there's some evidence that it really is happening. So I'll put that up there.
A quick a process question to outline for the committee. We are now a standing committee, so we can make a decision today and then go through this process, or we could table it to our next group meeting. When do we meet again to consider measures again?
Well, what we have going on right now with the endocrine project is we are actually in a pilot. So unlike most of our other projects, we are going to have another cycle of measurement. And I think our meetings for those measures are the second week of July, I believe.
Yes.
We could potentially, and I'll let Lindsay kick in on this because she's a lot more on our process. I will tell you that that's not something that other projects would be allowed to do. If we did something like that, it would be only because we are piloting this more frequent submission. So, Lindsay, what do you think?
I would, just to add to Karen's comments, I would say unless there's a specific input that you are looking for, a specific question that you want answered, we would not want to push it off any further because certainly at this point in time we've gotten input from the public, both prior to the in-person meeting and after the in-person meeting. The developer has done an additional analysis at this point, and so unless there's a different input that you're looking for, we really don't want to push it any further.
Okay. The only reason is that if we had stopped, I was weighing in the socioeconomic impact and the validity because of that. Now it would be a different discussion.
Just to speak to that process, certainly although these are draft recommendations right now, they'll go through NQF's governance. And they won't be required of measures until they're due back for maintenance, which would be in 3 years from now. So we have to give the developers time to run the analyses, to understand which potential socio-demographic factors they may need to include within a risk adjustment model. So given that, it would take time. It wouldn't be until 3 years that we would start to look for measures to have that information included.
Okay. Anybody else from the committee want to weigh in? I'm really looking for a signal from you as to whether you want to re-vote on this measure or if you want to stay with your original recommendation not to endorse the measure.
This is Ann Kearns. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So if we re-vote on the validity, then we still have to go through all the other steps to assess this measure, correct?
Right. So if you re-vote validity and it passes,
we still have all the other steps.
Well, we would have feasibility and then usability and use because you guys have already discussed importance and priority and gap and reliability.
Right.
So those are off the table. So what's on the table right now is do you want to vote at all? If so, you would vote on validity and then on feasibility, on usability and use, and then one final up or down recommendation for endorsement. So it would be 4 votes.
This is Sue Kirkman. I think we should vote.
Jim Duddle, I agree.
Okay. Is there any discussion about Kyle's new validity results? So again, he provided those in the memo that he provided.
This is Ann Letty speaking. I also would like to vote. I think the developer has done a very good job at addressing our concerns. And also, this was out for public comment, and the comments are attached to our documents. I'm ready to vote.
Sure. Okay. If there are no other comments on validity, we can move toward a vote. Okay, Sean, do you want to walk through briefly how the committee members should vote?
Absolutely. You should see right now some options to vote on your screen. Next to the A, B, C, and D option, you'll see a box, voting members, which are voting roster members only. You used your personalized link or you have your voting privileges assigned to enter the meeting today. If you simply click in that box next to the answer of your choice, your vote will be registered and we will be able to pull a report on the back end to see who voted what. And it looks like I believe we have 14 voting members on right now.
Okay, hold on a minute. We were thinking we had 16, Sean. Let's make sure we've got our counts right.
Yes, ma'am, you do. Actually, I had to scroll down a little further. I apologize.
Okay. Do we have 17?
Mm-hmm. If all committee members could please select a vote.
Yeah. Okay, so we have one high, 13 moderate, one low, zero insufficient, and we'll move forward.
Okay, so next we will discuss feasibility of the measure. Let's see, Kyle, remind me, this is all based on claims data, if I recall correctly.
Yes, that's correct.
And this is Bill Taylor. Does the feasibility change now that you've modified the criteria? I mean, I know all the comments were consistent with the committee's concern about, you know, what about people who switch to insulin? But do all the rest of these things now get influenced by the changes that are made? Nobody would comment on these, right, because, the changed way to identify patients and keep them in for a certain period is different now.
Right. I think the general feasibility criteria remains unchanged in that, you know, the data are collected in the same way. These are administrative data that are provided to CMS, and we were able to fully operationalize the committee's recommendations using the claims data. And we didn't have any, we didn't identify any feasibility concerns with operationalizing the data in that way. And we did have an expert in endocrinology as well as our full team, review those results.
Okay, any other questions about feasibility? Any discussion the committee wants to have on that? Okay,
is Bill Taylor again, and your example about metformin, if somebody were on metformin, they had to finish the period during which the metformin was prescribed in order to then be counted as switching to insulin. I mean, if somebody got onto insulin before the period was over in which their metformin prescription ran out, does that make problems in terms of your ability to collect who they are? I'm sorry, but it's tricky to understand all this in a short time and incorporated into how we're supposed to consider these different facets.
Sure. No, I think that's a good question. No, the data are based on, you know, prescription drug claim data that's turned into Part D. So if the patient actually, you know, filled the prescription, let's say for that last 30-day period for the metformin, they would get full credit for the 30 days for which they filled the prescription before, you know, the measurement period was truncated. And then once they didn't have a claim, an overlapping claim for insulin, you know, with metformin after that period ended, there wouldn't be any follow-up period at all. So I don't think there's a danger of misclassifying the patient. You know, I think there's a little bit of grace, you know, built in there automatically just by the way the measure is calculated.
Great. Thank you.
Right. Right. My understanding is you just wouldn't refill at the end of that period, and it doesn't really matter whether you stopped it, you know, a month into the period or 2.5 months into the period, right?
Correct.
So if the – this is Bill Curry. So if the patient continued the metformin and the insulin, they're still truncated from the denominator. Is that correct?
No. They're only as long as they can take insulin and an oral medication at the same time, and they are, you know, their follow-up period is followed up. However, at any point in time, if they stop, meaning that we see prior to the end of the measurement period that there's not coverage of the metformin, and they remain on insulin and no other oral diabetes agent, then the follow-up period is truncated. Otherwise, let's say, you know, if they were not adherent to metformin and insulin, then that, you know, that non-adherence would be captured by the insulin adherence wouldn't be captured, but the non-adherence to metformin would be captured by the algorithm.
And just to be clear for the members of the committee, I think the question here of feasibility is, do the data exist? And I think some of the questions being asked right now is a reflection of how you program the analysis of the existing data. But clearly, I think depending on how you program it, the data that's in existence could be changed to accommodate some of the questions that have been asked. So I think the feasibility is, can it be done because does the data exist, and then can you do the analysis on the data?
Mm-hmm. And we believe the answer to that question is yes on both accounts. Yes, the data are readily available. There aren't any issues with missing day supply related to the oral diabetes agents. It's very similar to the way we operationalize calculating adherence for other chronic medications like statins, you know, we think that this method to identify those that switch will effectively, you know, ensure that providers are not, you know, the adherence isn't underestimated.
I would like to suggest that maybe the committee should consider voting at this time on feasibility, unless someone has a burning concern or confusion.
Yes, Jim, vote.
Okay, we're pulling up
the screen.
Ready? Yep.
Okay.
Okay, voting is open.
I think we only have 15. No, 16. There it is.
We have 17, but looks like somebody's slacking.
They're non-adherent.
Last chance to vote.
Hi. I'm sorry. I'm having a little bit of a difficulty. When I select the item, am I supposed to then push enter? Or?
No, just click the box next to the answer.
Okay, I'll do that. Okay. Thank you.
And you hit your registration button when you came in.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so our final vote is 8 high, 8 moderate, 0 low, 0 insufficient, and we'll move on to usability.
Okay, so criterion for usability and use, basically we're interested in whether or not the measure has been in use. And in just a second, Poonam is going to switch us over to our staff review and work group summary because, you know, at least the work groups did discuss this. the developer describes planned use for the measure, but it is currently, my understanding is, it is not in use at this point. The other two sub-criteria under usability and use have to do with improvement. So is there any indication that with use of this measure that performance has gotten better? And then finally, we can talk about potential unintended consequences. So let me open it up there and see if the committee wants to discuss either of these items under usability and use.
And it's Bill Taylor again. Help me, please, how we think about usability when it has not been in use.
Yes, so for a brand new measure, you pretty much only have to think about, does it seem reasonable that it could be in use? This measure isn't new, and Kyle, you may have to help me here. Just a second, I'm going back. This is not a new measure, correct, Kyle? This is an older measure that was initially endorsed.
It was, but it is new in the sense that due to the complexity, NQF staff recommended that the measure be separated into its component parts. So, for example, the other two measures that have different NQF numbers, 545 and 2467, that look at statins and ACE ARBs, all of those were originally combined in one measure. And so this is the first time that the measure that looks at oral diabetes agents would stand alone. So from that perspective, it is new, and we did submit it to the NQF MAP for the measures under consideration process for ACO Shared Savings Program.
And Kyle, do you know when your original measure was endorsed?
I believe it was approximately 3 years ago. I think it was, we're on a 3-year cycle with this one.
Okay. Okay, and I'm pulling up.
The main unintended consequences I could see is we will get a zillion letters from managed care plans telling us the patient hasn't picked up a prescription. I've already hit too many of them as it is.
Any other comments on usability and use?
And just to put this in a little bit more perspective, the unintended consequences we're really interested in would be unintended consequences to the patient.
True, but it is an increased expense to the health system when you get all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Right, ready to vote?
Yes.
Okay, voting is open. Okay, so we have 2 high, 13 moderate, 1 low, 0 insufficient, and we'll go on to the final vote.
Any other overall considerations before we move to a final vote? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and move to the final vote.
Okay, voting is open. Okay, so we have 15 yes, 1 no, and this measure will be recommended for endorsement.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to move on now to measure 2418. This was another one of the measures that you as a committee did not recommend for endorsement in the in-person meeting. And just to remind you, that measure was set up where either provision of discharge instructions or referral to a fracture liaison service, either of those things would have met the measure. And the committee did not choose to recommend this measure for endorsement because of lack of evidence showing that discharge instructions could actually impact outcomes in a positive way. So we did receive four comments in the post-evaluation period, and all four comments were non-supportive of your recommendation not to endorse. However, none of the commenters, while they noted their non-support of your decision, they did not offer any additional evidence that would potentially make a difference, I would think, in your recommendation. So the question that I would like you guys to consider was any new evidence presented either in the comments or, you know, since the meeting, have you found anything new that would make you reconsider your decision not to recommend this measure for endorsement?
And to just clarify a process issue here, the question on the table would be a vote for reconsideration. I would assume by NQF processes we could reconsider by a majority vote of the committee, or does it take a two-thirds vote?
Basically, for this one, I think it's more just if there's a gestalt from the committee that you feel like you want to revote, you could do that. This measure did go down on evidence, so if you decide to revote, you'd have to go through the entire voting process.
No, but as a general rule, if we have made a decision, obviously, we wouldn't do a reconsideration here if there wasn't at least a majority, and I didn't know if there was a process where there had to be a majority or a two-thirds vote to reconsider. I'm taking from your comments it's a majority vote.
Yeah, a simple majority will work.
So this is Sue Kirkman. I would move that we not re-vote on this measure. I mean, it went down on evidence. There's no new evidence presented, and just because people aren't happy doesn't mean we should revote.
No, I will second that.
Tracy Green, I agree that.
Great. I agree.
Agree.
Karen and committee, excuse me, this is Ann Watt from the Joint Commission. I just did want to point out that in one of the public comments to NQF, there was an additional citation provided. And my colleague, Kathy Domzowski, is here, and perhaps she could just briefly, because I know that you're on time constraints, you know, describe this to you. Whether it changes your minds or not, I don't know. But
Hi, this is Kathy. Hi, everyone. In the comments submitted by Amgen et others, there was a study appearing in Osteoporosis International, which was a meta-analysis conducted by Ganda et al., and it looked at four models to reduce the risk of further fractures among fragility fracture patients. And the four models ranged in intensity from type A, which was full intensity identification, assessment, and treatment, type B, without treatment, C, physician alerts, and D, patient education. And the findings were that the more intense interventions of type A, identification, assessment, and treatment, as part of the service would cover a fracture liaison service, but type B, similar to A, without initiating treatment, was also more effective. And I would also like to just recap some of the evidence that was submitted. There was a Cochrane collaboration.
Okay, well, I think we have that evidence. So.
Thank you.
I would like to suggest to the NQF staff that we put to the committee a vote, we can still have discussion, about whether we want to reconsider as a yes or a no vote that we can vote on this call. If that's okay, can we do that?
Okay. Hold on just a minute.
So we'll do the revote. If you could.
Not a revote. We're just asking if anybody is
interested in reconsidering.
Yeah.
If you could use the raise your hand function on, I believe it's the upper left-hand side of your screen. Raise your hand if you are interested in reconsidering.
All right. But we're not ready to vote quite yet, so make sure anybody else on the committee has any further comments before we vote.
We had a previous motion not to vote, but we're not voting on that. We're voting the opposite way.
No. The question on the table was, do we want to reconsider the measure? And I gather there was testimony to say we should not reconsider the measure. So.
Right, but it sounded like the instructions were to raise your hand if you wanted to reconsider the measure, and that's not how the motion was made.
That is correct. But we can at least clarify the intent of how you're voting it. So.
To raise your hand if you want to reconsider.
Please.
Right.
We will restate the measure in a minute, but. Does anybody else have any comments about desiring to reconsider?
This is Anne. I did not have a chance to read the referenced article in Osteoporosis International. Has anybody on the committee done that, or did anybody do that when we had our in-person meeting?
So this is Bill Curry. Actually, during our discussion, I did reference the Ganda article in Osteoporosis International. It was part of the discussion, and the evidence from the meta-analysis shows that when an intervention such as giving discharge instructions, asking a patient to follow up with their provider because of a fragility fracture, it made no impact in their follow-on care. It's a Class D, or Model D, of the four models in the Ganda article, and it was not cost-effective, nor was it of any efficacy in improving fracture care. So we had talked about it at our committee meeting at the in-person meeting.
Thank you.
Okay.
Other comments from the committee? So if we want to vote, if you want to reconsider, correct, we hit the raise your hand button.
Correct.
Where is that again?
I'm sorry, I'm not being able to raise my hand.
See where it says meeting info in the upper left corner?
I do, thank you.
Right there.
And all you need to do is simply click that one time and a little hand should show up for you.
So raise your hand if you want to reconsider the measure.
This is Jesse. I don't want to reconsider the measure, but raising my hand isn't working. So just, I'd prefer we didn't use that method.
Okay. We have no hands raised anyway to reconsider the measure. So at
I
this
see
point,
one.
There's I
one
thought
now.
There's one that's kind of coming and going, but. At this point, we just have, well, it's coming and going. One or none hand has been raised, so at this point, we'll move forward.
Okay, thank you for...
That is me. I'm so sorry. All right.
Okay. Our next point of discussion is about measure 0555, Comprehensive Diabetes Care Eye Exam Performed. And there were 7 comments that came in regarding this measure. 4 of them were supportive of the measure and your decision to recommend for endorsement. 2 of the comments just wanted clarification from the developer as to why women with polycystic ovarian syndrome are excluded, and the developer did respond to that. let me just keep going. Another commenter was concerned about a couple of CPT codes, particularly 92227 and 92228. Both of those are related to remote imaging, so there was a concern about those CPT codes being included in the measure. And then finally, there was a comment suggesting that the measure be aligned with the new age specifications that NCQA agreed to for their foot measure. And just to remind you on that one, initially both of those measures were specified for patients ages 18 to 75. For the foot measure, NCQA did agree to drop the age limitation, drop the 75 limit. So the commenter was curious as about whether that should also be done for the eye exam measure. So let me open it up. Well, I guess, first of all, I guess, do we have anybody from NCQA on the phone?
Yes, you have a room full of people from NCQA on the phone. This is Mary Barton, Vice President for Performance Measurement.
Why don't we split the question also for sake of simplicity? Because we have two separate issues on the table. So the first issue would be the remote imaging, and the second would be the harmonization of age. So why don't we start, and we have to consider both of these commentaries. So why don't we discuss the remote imaging issue first?
This is Mary Barton from NCQA. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You're a little distant, but you're okay.
Okay, so let's see. With regard to remote imaging, we have been trying to track down this question since we heard it, and maybe not coincidentally, it had also come in through our own policy clarification system that I think I had described to the steering committee as our own continuous feedback loop when we hear from the folks who use our measures about questions they have. We are, because this is a claims-based measure and it relies on claims that Medicare assigns to appropriate or imaging, I won't say appropriate, but I'll say CMS assigns the codes to imaging they pay for. And as long as there are decisions that are made by CMS about what they will pay for, we are, it's a little hard for us to parse the question of whether this new technology is what's being done or not, for one. And two, I think that my contacts within the diabetes expert world, and I would certainly be interested to hear any thoughts the steering committee has, would suggest to me that the diabetes expert world is reluctant to say that they would endorse the use of this particular technology, but they've actually not gone so far in their guideline as to say that right out. So we as measure developers are just a little bit between a rock and a hard place here. So I, as I said, well, I'm kind of curious what the steering committee would say.
So this is Sue Kirkman, and maybe I don't understand this comment, but I disagree that this goes against the ADA guidelines. The ADA guidelines say that retinal photographs are acceptable.
I think the question that I, as I understood it, was that the OptiMap technology, which is a non-dilating retinal image, is not precisely the same as a kind of as a retinal photograph that might have been imagined 7 years ago when the CPT code was created. But I could be totally confused about this, and I'm happy to be corrected.
This is Bill Goldwyn. I sat on the PCPI committee that discussed a similar measure. This is about 6 or 7 years ago. And there was extensive discussion about remote imaging, such as in this measure. And there was considerable evidence presented that it was acceptable technology. And the members of that committee, which included people from the Endocrine Society, were comfortable that this was an acceptable technology. So I'm a little bit surprised by the commentary. And I don't know how, what other people on the committee have in terms of experience.
And certainly places like the VA are doing, you know, doing a lot of this.
This is Bill Taylor. Are there any studies, you know, comparing the photographs with assessment by a human being and, you know, validity?
I think there are a lot of studies, and it's actually pretty good. I mean, it may even be better than humans.
So shouldn't that tell us?
You know, again, it gets read by an expert. It's not just the photo itself.
We're having a little trouble with our mute button. Can you hear me now? This is Mary Barton.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so it sounds like in all, the steering committee would not necessarily support the commenter's assertion, and so therefore our response that we have no, that we would not intend to make a change in our measure as it's currently specified would stand.
And getting to the NQF staff, do we need to do anything else with this measure? There's nothing to vote on. It's just to frame your response.
Exactly. And I think from the conversation we've had, we are ready to move on to the next comment. So thank you.
So now we go to the next comment, which is the age issue.
So
Mary, do you want to make any comments on the age?
Thank you for asking. We are, this question, you know, would be a reasonable question if we only had two indicators and it was important to make them match, but instead we have a set of indicators, as you heard that day, and this would not, a change in the age category would not be a no-brainer. It would be appropriate to seriously consider for, and I'll just toss out, you know, hemoglobin A1C less than 8 measure, where I dare say the steering committee would not be unanimous on an expansion of the age category, the age range. So I'm reluctant to go sort of imposing a sort of unsubstantiated uniformity across the diabetes indicators without giving full due consideration to the issues related to patients of that age group. So we would not want to make any on-the-fly changes.
So this is Sue Kirkman. I mean, I think there's a difference between talking about blood glucose goals versus screening for complications. So pretty much all the diabetes complications impact older people disproportionately. So I think we have to really think about why we would exclude older people from a measure that's screening for a complication that's prevalent.
Other comments? NQF staff, do you need additional framework here?
No, I think what we're looking for here, we're certainly not expecting that NCQA would make a change anytime soon, but if the committee felt that that was an important change that they need to seriously consider, now's the time to tell them that they, you know, you would like them to really consider that. Or perhaps you might say, you know, 75 is okay for this measure.
This is Jessie. I guess what I would say is that, you know, before the idea was to have a measure with one age, and with the foot exam we got away from that. So now we have a measure with two different denominators. So I think it makes sense to say to NCQA, now that you no longer have one denominator, you have two, can't you look at each of the other sections of this measure and make sure that the ones that are appropriate for an older population fall into that older denominator, because we've already got two denominators.
Okay.
Any other discussion?
Well, this is Mary Barton. We appreciate that input, and we're glad to take all this back to our panels.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay. The next measures that came up in our comments were the two glucose control measures, hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia. And for those, we received 6 comments. And the concern, the main concern was low reliability scores for one of the hospitals. So there was some testing done, and the reliability scores were fine for most of the sites, but except for the one hospital and the one measure, and I think 2 in the other measure. And then there was also a desire from this commenter that the measures be computed in a similar way. And that actually came up in the in-person meeting. You guys questioned, you know, why they were computed in a different way. And that was an item of discussion. And then finally, a couple other commenters were kind of diametrically opposed. One wasn't even sure if there was a need for the measures, and another expressed support for the measures. So in both cases, we asked the developer to respond to the question regarding reliability, and the developer did do that. And in both cases, the developer, I think, is Kyle, right, Kyle? I don't, or is it MCQA? I'm sorry, I'm getting
that's
my...
That's correct. Yeah. It's Kyle Campbell from MQA. Yep. Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I'm getting mixed up here. So I think maybe you want to just give a very, very brief... You've already given us your response written here, and I've included that in the memo, but maybe you want to take, you know, a very quick 1-minute discussion of your response, and then... the question to the committee is, from these comments, was there any new information or anything questioned to make you want to reconsider your decision regarding the reliability of the measure? So, Kyle, you want to just give us the quick version of your response?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think it's important to note that this commenter did support the steering committee's recommendation to endorse the 2 measures. With regard to the reliability, the lowest reliability that we found, we had one hospital within our national test bed that was a critical access hospital, which only has 25 beds. And that particular hospital had an unreliable score for both the hyperglycemia and the hypoglycemia measure. The only other hospital with an approaching, I guess, a reliable score was a hospital in the hypoglycemia measure where we had a 0.67, and that's really closely approaching, you know, reliability is not an absolute criterion, and when we start to see a signal to noise, coefficient of approximately 0.7, it generally means that we can statistically differentiate the providers from the mean. So in this case, we don't have any concerns here. We think that, we would look at this concerning implementation in smaller facilities, but that would be the case for any of the measures that would, you know, potentially be implemented in CMS reporting programs. And so I think that really addresses the reliability issue overall. And you did discuss the specification of the measures. We really don't see an opportunity to do that because hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia are very different types of events, hyperglycemia being sustained over a period of time, where hypoglycemia being more of an isolated event, and we don't think there's an opportunity to further align those measures and for the measures to remain valid.
I have a brief question. At the end of your comment, your comment is basically the same for both these 2 measures. You made the comment where severe hypoglycemia is a rare event that occurs after administration. You know, there was a paper this week that said hypoglycemia is now becoming more common as an admission than hyperglycemia. Do you want to continue with that statement in this discussion?
I think the statement would be that it's a relatively rare event when we're talking about severe hypoglycemia less than 40 milligrams per deciliter. I mean, essentially, you know, we're finding measure rates, you know, approximately around the 1%. Whereas with, you know, hyperglycemia, measure rates are 20 to 30%. So I agree that hypoglycemia has been identified in the National Action Plan and is one of the most frequently occurring ADEs, but it's still relatively rare compared to the sustained hyperglycemia that we see, at least from our data sample, the data that we saw.
Other comments from the committee?
I don't see any reason to change the measure. I think it was very thoughtfully and logically developed.
Okay.
Does NQF staff need additional input aside from our acceptance of the material from the developer?
That's pretty much it. We just wanted to make sure that the commenter was responded to. And that you guys agree with the comment, so that's great. We're at the end of our memo. We're almost at the end of our call. I would, you know, obviously you saw the things that I pulled out of all those comments that we had, but if there are any other comments that came through that you guys would like to discuss, we'd be happy to take those now. And it's okay if there isn't.
Why don't you go over next steps also, just so we know what's coming up down the road?
Mm-hmm. Actually, if we could just take a brief moment to do NQF member and public comment. Operator, if you could open the lines, please.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, if you have a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the comment roster. We have no public comments at this time.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to hand it over to Katie now to tell us about next steps.
Sure. So as for next steps, NQF staff will update the comment table with responses to reflect discussion during today's call. We'll also be updating our draft report to include the comments and responses from developers and committee. The draft report will be posted on June 6th, which is when all of the measures that were recommended for endorsement will be available for NQF member voting. That's a 15-day voting period. After that, the measures, all of your recommendations will be reviewed during a CSAC meeting in July. For cycle 2, which is surprisingly rapidly approaching, the submission deadline is June 6th. So we'll be sending you measures that come in for review cycle 2 by the last week of June. Then we'll be reconvening with two conference calls, as Karen mentioned earlier, the second week of July, and that's when we'll have you review all the new measure submissions. We would like to note that we will not be having work group calls because we anticipate a much lower number of measures that will be coming in for review cycle 2. So it'll be important that you review each measure and submit your preliminary evaluation comments using the survey tool that will be available on SharePoint. And we'll make all of the comments available to the whole committee before we reconvene that second week in July. Are there any questions about next steps? We'll send all this out in an email so everyone's clear on exactly what to be doing and what's going on and the timeline of everything.
This is Claudia. I don't have a question yet. I just have a comment that I really appreciated the format that you submitted all of the comments to us in the overview. It really helped in thinking about them.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions, comments? Otherwise, we can end today's call a little bit early, have some time back.
Terrific.
Great.
Great. Okay, if you guys have any questions or anything, we're still at the same email address and phone number, so give us a call if you need to, and we will be in touch.
And thank you to the developers who joined us also.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.